Welcome to Your Call, the Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Yesterday, President Donald Trump announced his decision to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. The United States thereby joins only two other countries in the world who are not signed on to the agreement, Syria and Nicaragua. Mr. Trump said he might consider rejoining the Paris Agreement or negotiating a new agreement if it was fair for the United States. He stressed that he was making this decision with the best interests of American workers at heart, a core piece of his America First agenda. Clip will be coming up in a moment. Of course, as mentioned, President Trump's decision was rebuked by other nations as irresponsible toward the future of the planet, and it angered the governors of California, New York, and Washington State, who promptly formed the United States Climate Alliance. Governor Jerry Brown declared that California will remain a leader against climate change with or without the White House.
There's two things. Number one, climate change is a hoax. That's his first value proposition. His second is that it was created by China. And the truth is that China is on a path to do a hell of a lot more than the Trump administration in dealing with climate change. So if there's any hoax, it's in the White House, not in Beijing.
We'll try to get back to the clip from President Trump in a moment, but first let me introduce our guest today. We're very fortunate to have two of the very best reporters who've been covering the climate beat for as long as it's really been a major news story, and very happy to welcome to the show first Bill McKibben, longtime author and journalist. His piece in the New York Times yesterday, a commentary on the president's decision, is called Trump's Stupid and Reckless Climate Decision, and he joins us by phone on the road. Bill McKibben, thanks for being with us.
Mark, what a pleasure.
Thanks. And also from London, Fiona Harvey. She's an environment correspondent for The Guardian newspaper. She's covered every United Nations climate meeting since 2004, including the signing of the Paris Accord in December 2015. Fiona Harvey, very good to have you with us.
Hello.
So let's begin here, and I should say just quickly here, we'll be joined later in the show by David Marcus, who's the books and arts editor at The Nation magazine, when we talk about books. But for now, we're going to be talking about President Trump's decision to withdraw from the climate accord, and especially the media coverage of it. Bill McKibben, you've been watching how and participating in how the media covers this story for a long time for now. So let's first talk, both of you, what of the coverage so far on the climate accord story, what's been the best coverage that you've seen?
Well, several things. I mean, credit where it's due, Amy Harder, later the Wall Street Journal and now of Axios, really was the person who got the scoop saying that he was going to pull out of Paris. I thought that, Mark, your piece in The Nation yesterday and all of this was really terrific. And I thought that a piece that Naomi Klein wrote for the, I think, Daily News yesterday, making the point that now is the time for Europeans and others to start figuring out how to sanction America's lawlessness in economic terms, and things, was one of the most new and provocative ideas. I guess I'd say in the end it was the editors at the Daily News themselves who kind of took home the prize. Today's headline across the front page of the Daily News is Trump to World, Drop Dead, which I think sums it up pretty well.
Of course, that is a recollection of the famous headline from the 1970s with President Ford to New York City, Drop Dead. Fiona Harvey, what's the coverage that stood out for you so far?
Well, I think the coverage has been good in the sense that there was a bit of a time lag between when we thought the president was going to make the announcement and then when he actually did make the announcement. So people were able to prepare, really. So I think we did get a greater depth of coverage and perhaps breadth of coverage because of that. So in that sense, it was a good thing, that little delay. But in terms of the tone of the coverage, I think there's there's been a very wide variation in tone from the sort of quite sort of sobered and factual to, you know, people on both sides of the electoral divide sort of either hailing it as a victory or a disaster. I think actually, you know, as with most of these things, it's probably more nuanced than that. And the reality is it's somewhere in between. I don't think this is a complete disaster for the Paris Agreement, nor is it a wonderful victory for Donald Trump necessarily. And I think, you know, it's been difficult sometimes to sort out the more moderate coverage from the slightly more impassioned.
That's Fiona Harvey with The Guardian newspaper in London. We're also joined by Bill McKibben, who is a scholar at Middlebury College and the founder of the activist organization 350.org. And before we go further, I want to just say to all everyone listening, of course, we want to be hearing from you as well. Let me give you the number to call in a few minutes, 866-798-8255. And, of course, you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or 866-798-8255. Bill McKibben, you had very strong views about this yesterday in the New York, or I guess today in the New York Times. As you look at this and compare it to how you've watched climate politics change over the 25 years you've been covering this story, what stands out to you about this decision? Does it fit broadly within what we've seen so far, or is it, as some people are saying, a really landmark shifting of ground?
Well, I think that all you need to know what a how much of an outlier it is the fact that Syria and Nicaragua are the only two other countries that aren't party to this thing. It's not very many things in the world where you can get absolutely every country to agree. I thought that watching the president make his address, we were reminded probably more forcefully than any time yet in his presidency of what a dimwit he is. He clearly knows next to nothing about any of this. Has one set of, as it turns out, completely wrong talking points that fact checkers around the internet have spent the last 24 hours debunking. But, you know, the real amazing part of it was the sense in story after story that he was making up his mind at the last minute, and that if Ivanka had gotten to him, he might well have gone in a different direction or whatever. I mean, this is the biggest crisis that human beings have yet run into. And the fact that this guy can't be bothered to even try and understand the stakes is crazy. I guess the way to think about it is, ask yourself, what are the chances that all the world's scientists and all the world's diplomats and most of the world's, almost all the world's economists are wrong about this, and that Donald Trump has somehow by himself stumbled onto the truth? I think the odds of that are small to the literal point of vanishing, and I think that's why people will remember this in 100 years, if we're around in 100 years, as the main thing that Donald Trump did, and I think they'll curse his name.
Bill, we seem to be losing you on your cell phone. Can you try and I'm going to switch to Fiona Harvey here for a second and ask you to try and get to a stationary spot there where we won't lose you. Fiona Harvey of the Guardian newspaper. Of course, I imagine it looks somewhat different there in Europe, where Donald Trump has not a great reputation, let's face it. He has attacked NATO. He has accused European nations and, of course, China of unfair trade deals. Did Europeans, and I'm talking here specifically about the media, do they see this as sort of more of the same from Donald Trump, or does the existential nature of the climate crisis bring out a different strand of coverage?
Well, it's interesting because I don't think that many people are all that shocked that Mr. Trump has taken this decision. I think there's a little bit of a lack of understanding in some of the European coverage over how Mr. Trump gets to take this decision by himself. But the the impact of the decision has been mitigated by the actions that have been taken here in Europe, because at the same time as Mr. Trump was making his announcement, the leaders of the European Union, the European Union was holding a summit with China here in Europe. So people were preparing to talk about climate change as part of that. It was one of the three main issues, along with trade and migration, that were being discussed at that summit. And so the ground was already set for the EU and China to reaffirm their commitment to Paris, even before Mr. Trump decided to make his announcement. So when Mr. Trump made his decision, of course, there was a perfect opportunity for the EU and Paris to, you know, take the stage and say, well, we will carry on without the United States. And that's been very much the dominant tone of coverage here, is that, Mr. Trump has decided to pull out, but the EU and China have forged an alliance to carry on. And we should remember that, of course, it was the US and China who made their groundbreaking announcement, their joint deal, just before Paris, that set the scene for Paris. So now the United States is being swapped out for Europe in that scenario.
And do the, with the European Union and China together, that's the second and the third biggest economies in the world, is the view over in Europe now that it doesn't matter if the United States drops out of the Paris Accord, we can still do enough together to push clean energy and get rid of fossil fuels, that we can honor the commitment to keep temperature rise below 2 degrees? Fiona Harvey first, and then Bill McKibben, who's back with us.
I don't think I'd go so far as to say people think it doesn't matter. The tone of coverage, the things people have been saying, definitely it's a serious issue, and it's a blow, and it's not regarded as a positive thing, certainly, that Mr. Trump has pulled out. But you have to remember that we have been here before. Under President George W. Bush, the U.S. Took part in United Nations meetings on climate change, but as soon as the UN or the other nations of the UN wanted to move forward to forge a new agreement beyond Kyoto that would eventually replace Kyoto, and that eventually after years became the Paris Agreement, when the rest of the world wanted to do that, under George W. Bush, the United States refused. And so what happened was the rest of the world carried on negotiating. The UN's refusal did not destroy, sorry, the United States' refusal did not destroy the United Nations process of negotiation.
Bill McKibben, I'm glad to have you back with us now. Can I just ask you, you have studied the science of this longer than any other journalist. You wrote the first groundbreaking book, The End of Nature, back in 1989. As you look now at the United States pulling out of this Paris Accord and the fact that the European Union and China are saying we're going ahead, that Governor Jerry Brown in California and the governors of New York and Washington State and mayors across the country are saying we're going ahead, and Tim Cook, the Apple company CEO, says we're going to go ahead anyway. Do you think that all of that forward motion, despite Trump's withdrawal of the U.S. federal government from climate action, can we still, with all of that forward motion, keep the temperature rise below 2 degrees as the Paris Accord envisioned?
Well, as you know, Mark, the actual pledges and promises in the Paris Agreement, even if we had met them all, would have allowed the temperature of the planet to rise 3.5 degrees Celsius. The 2 degree target was sort of set there for rhetorical purposes, and the hope has been that if we really got going, people would start ratcheting up their ambition, and that we would find that there was kind of a virtuous cycle where the falling price of renewable energy was making it easier and easier to get where we needed to go. And there were some signs of that starting to happen, especially in China and India. But I think that what Trump has done is probably make sure that there's not going to be that exponential increase in momentum, that ongoing and rapid acceleration that was our big hope here. we'll all do the best we can, and we'll be very grateful to California for leadership and work hard to spread it around the world. But I don't think one should underestimate what happened yesterday. This was this ranks as one of the very stupidest decisions that any important world leaders ever made, and we should be deeply ashamed as Americans today.
Bill McKibben, that's Bill McKibben with the group 350.org, and he is a scholar at Middlebury College in Vermont, and also his piece yesterday in the New York Times, which of course will be on our website here, is called Trump's Stupid and Reckless Climate Decision. Also joining us from London is Fiona Harvey. She's the correspondent for The Environment at The Guardian newspaper, and she has covered every UN climate meeting since 2004. Bill, I know you have to leave us shortly, so let me just play devil's advocate here for a second and give the president his due here, where he made the argument yesterday in his speech that this is, quote, very unfair, that the Paris Accord is very unfair to the United States. He said it's not fair that China and India get to keep polluting and the United States has to shut down its coal plants. It's not fair that the United States has to pay billions of dollars into the climate fund. What do you make of all that?
I think it's pathetic whining. If there's anything that's unfair in this world, and boy, is it unfair, it's that the U.S., with 5% of the world's population, accounts for by far the largest share of the climate pollution in the atmosphere. It's the rest of the world that should be eternally pissed off at us, not vice versa. Donald Trump is a baby. He talks like a four-year-old all the time. Me. And it was depressing and embarrassing to have to listen to him yesterday. And I do have to go, but I want to just thank Fiona for all her good work, and Mark, you for yours. On we go. And the key thing, I think, at this point is just to keep telling the truth about all this.
Thank you very much. That's Bill McKibben joining us from the road. He is a scholar at Middlebury College and the author of many, many books and articles, including The End of Nature. Still with us is Fiona Harvey with The Guardian newspaper. Fiona, can I talk to you? And there's a part of me that kind of wishes you were a French journalist right now, because the president twice, not once, but twice, called out the city of Paris in his speech yesterday as denigrating that place, apparently for the audacity of hosting this conference that came up with this Paris Accord. He said, I'm elected to serve the people of Pittsburgh, not Paris. And then, in case you missed it, he closed again at the end of his speech saying, I'm here for Youngstown, Ohio, and Detroit, Michigan, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, not for Paris, France. That kind of rhetoric kind of calls to mind the way that the United States Congress, after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, when France dared to criticize that, Republicans in Congress tried to ban French fries from Capitol Hill cafeterias. And I'm just wondering, does that affect how Europeans are receiving President Trump's decision yesterday to withdraw from the Paris Accord?
Well, I'm afraid I'm not in Paris at the moment, but the French did take a great deal of pride in the Paris Agreement, partly because the French government must take a lot of the credit for actually making the agreement. They put in years of painstaking diplomacy. They did a very good job. But more importantly, of course, for the people of Paris, it was rather a personal thing to have the leaders of the world leaders, flew in, and it was just a very short time, just a few weeks after the awful murderous terrorist attacks in Paris that shocked Parisians and appalled the world. And I was at the meeting in Paris for its entirety, and I can tell you what an emotional experience it was. And everyone who was there felt it, to be in that city at that time, and for the people of Paris to welcome the rest of the world. So just on that level, I think it's rather disappointing with Mr. Trump.
Yes, I can validate that myself. I was there for that summit, and it was quite impressive. And I just want to quickly read that the mayor of Pittsburgh yesterday responded to President Trump's statement with a tweet, quote, "As the mayor of Pittsburgh, I can assure you that we will follow the guidelines of the Paris Agreement for our people, our economy, and our future," unquote. We're going to take a call now from Roberta in San Leandro. Welcome to the show, Roberta.
Thank you. I appreciate it. My comment is simply that I was outraged when I was listening to the president state that he loves the environment. That was so hypocritical. And number two, look who he put in charge of our EPA and how all of our budget is being cut, and they're not even addressing the critical factors here about how corporations and possibly the president's own investments not in coal, but maybe in coal, but things like, you know, fossil fuels. He's just lining his own pockets and his friends, his newfound friends, who have encouraged him to drop the Paris Accord from the United States. And I'm completely outraged. I'm not dumbfounded. I don't know how we can stop this other than relying on our governors and city mayors to really pick up the mantle and bring it forward, knowing that we as citizens need clean water and clean air and good, healthy food and things that don't create, ill disease in our own bodies, It's okay. I don't understand where his disconnect is. I really don't.
Thanks very much. Fiona Harvey, how is that looked at in Europe, this decision of Trump's, the motivation for it? Is it taken on sort of face value that this is about America first, or the caller's point that the president is perhaps seen as a friend of big oil? He did, after all, bring Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of ExxonMobil, in as his Secretary of State.
I think you've got to try and discern in all of this, where do America's true interests lie? If you want to put America first, and, nations all around the world put themselves first, but we live on a planet that we share. And it doesn't make sense to trash that planet for the sake of your own country, because you've still got to breathe the air. You're going to experience the climate along with everyone else. You're going to experience migration as people leave the bits of the world that are most vulnerable. You're going to experience the same global economy as other nations. So we live in a connected world already, and we live on one planet. So it really doesn't make sense in the long term for any nation to try and pursue what they perceive as their own goals at the expense of everyone else and the planet we live on. In terms of how this will be seen internationally, Mr. Trump does have allies in some of the fossil fuel industries, but I think what's been most remarkable to observe from the outside is the way that a lot of businesses whom one might have expected to line up behind Mr. Trump have actually opposed him in rejecting his rejection of the Paris Agreement. They are businesses like ExxonMobil, like Mr. Tillerson, the Secretary of State, used to be the chief executive of Exxon. They wanted to remain within the Paris Agreement. So the way in which Mr. Trump's allies have divided among this has been very interesting to watch.
We're going to be bringing in David Baker shortly after the break. David covers energy and clean technology for the San Francisco Chronicle. He'll be joining us shortly. His recent article is, quote, "Defying Trump, California Forms Climate Alliance with Two States." We'll be talking about that shortly after this break. If you've just joined us, I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call.
Your call on KLW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. A tweet is also an option. We're at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point with host Lauren Schiller. Stay with us.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Hertzgard. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar this Friday, and this is Your Call, the Friday Media Roundtable. And let me just note, we're podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about the future of coral reefs and the documentary Chasing Coral, which is featured at the San Francisco International Ocean Film Festival. Today, we're discussing President Donald Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. We're joined by Fiona Harvey. She's the environment correspondent for The Guardian newspaper in London. She has covered every United Nations climate conference since 2004, including the Paris conference in December 2015. We had Bill McKibben of Middlebury College and 350.org. He had to leave for another appointment. But joining us now is David Baker, and he covers energy and clean technology for the San Francisco Chronicle. And his piece is about, quote, define Trump, California forms climate alliance with two states. David Baker, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Very good. David, before we go to you and back to you, Fiona, we have a caller, Jeff, in the East Bay. Let's take his call first. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Morning. Don't you really think that this is Trump showmanship? I know it's a dangerous subject, but there have been, you know, usually they ask positive good news articles. One was Frontline on Steve Bannon, and this has been a big thing for him, but he also knows the good timing of placing these things to distract people. Trump also made this totally showmanship. Stay tuned until 3 o'clock tomorrow, and then I'll tell you. That dominated the news cycle. Plus, on the Today Show this morning, they said this withdrawal is totally unnecessary because the U.S. can revise its terms and conditions, and every 5 years there is a review of this. So this was just a grandstand for him because other things could have been done just as effectively.
Let's tackle that. Fiona Harvey in London with The Guardian newspaper. What do you make of that? Was it just showmanship on Trump's part?
Sorry, was it?
Was it showmanship on Donald Trump's part, the way that he made this announcement? Was it a distraction from perhaps the Russia influence investigation?
Yeah, I think the caller is absolutely right in using the word the term showmanship, because it's hard to think of anything that Donald Trump does that doesn't have an element of showmanship. But there is a sort of a substance here. It's not as if Mr. Trump had not signaled his intent. He did during the campaign. He sent out tweets and so on. He vowed on several occasions that he would withdraw the U.S. support from Paris. So we did know. It just is still surprising, I suppose, in the sense that there was opposition to it from within Mr. Trump's own allies, and that there was so little modification. It was rather an abrupt withdrawal. Didn't really give much quarter. In terms of the real effect, rather than the showmanship. In a sense, the Paris Agreement itself is more of an act of showmanship than it is a real sort of target. Because, as Bill McKibben was saying earlier, the actual commitments under Paris don't get us to the 2 degrees target, or limit, rather. they would take us beyond that. Warming would go beyond that. So in a sense, Paris is more of a totem or an icon. It's more of an aspiration. It's really a statement that we will solve this global problem collectively as a world. That is the important thing about Paris. So it's more symbolic than it is about concrete action. But sometimes symbolism is extremely important.
Yes, I want to reinforce that from my own reporting in Paris. I remember interviewing the John Schellenhuber, who is the was at that point the chief climate advisor to the German government. And he said that the important thing about putting these 2-degree and even 1.5-degree targets in that agreement was that it gives civil society, including business and activists and the media, for that matter, a stick with which to hold governments to account and say, look, you've got to do better than your declared commitments. You've got to reduce emissions enough to get it down to 2 degrees. Let me switch now to David Baker of the San Francisco Chronicle. Very impressive, David, that you were able to get that story up so quickly about the this new climate alliance between the state of California, state of New York, and state of Washington. Tell us a little bit about that. Was that in the making, that alliance, in advance of Trump's decision? And what's it going to look like? And are cities going to be part of that as well?
Well, you got to think. The press release that we got from the governor's office came out, I think, less than an hour after Trump's announcement. So you got to think that that had been in the works for quite a long time. But you know, they were reading the same tea leaves as all the rest of us. They knew that this announcement was going to come sooner or later. And Brown has often collaborated, at least with Inslee in the past, Governor Inslee of Washington State, on climate issues. Not necessarily so much with Governor Cuomo, but yeah, I'm quite certain they were laying the groundwork for this months ago.
And Governor Brown, either this weekend or next week, is on his way to China to continue the collaboration between California and China. Again, Governor Brown is the governor of the 6th largest economy in the world. I remember when he was at the Paris summit, he is treated as a head of state by other nations. Is China going to be part of this climate alliance with California and New York and Washington State?
I have a hard time, the way this is framed, I have a hard time seeing China joining this alliance. I mean, this one looks very much focused on corralling U.S. states. Governor Brown does obviously have his own international climate agreement that he's been pushing for the last couple of years, the Under 2 MOU, as it's called. And there are already several Chinese provinces that have signed on to it.
Yeah, let's explain that, David. What does Under 2 MOU mean?
It's basically an agreement targeting states, provinces, and subnational governments, all trying to get them to agree to steps that will keep global warming beneath 2 degrees centigrade within this century. It was initially intended just to be subnational, but now there are some actual, like, full countries like Sweden, Canada, and Mexico that have joined as well. But this has become sort of the centerpiece of Brown's personal climate diplomacy. He goes to conferences around the world. He's about to head off to one in Germany after China, and basically badgers politicians into joining this thing. And I think at this point he's got about 170 signatories to it. So he's apparently pretty effective at what he's doing.
Fiona Harvey in London, can you quickly fill us in on how does the government of Prime Minister May in the UK, how are they responding to all this, both President Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Accord and generally climate policy, where the EU has been such a leader and Britain has such a strong scientific background in climate policy, but what about government policy these days?
Well, here in the UK, we are in the midst of a general election, a surprise general election, so a very quick one. So the Prime Minister's actions have come under even more scrutiny than usual, and she's caused some controversy by appearing to be rather lukewarm in her condemnation of Donald Trump. In fact, it's not really condemnation at all. She has been not really very willing to speak about it at all. She wouldn't join in with the other European, with the other G7 leaders or with other European leaders in rebuking Mr. Trump on this. And really, she is she's given the impression that she would really rather not have to address it at all.
Is that likely to hurt her in the election, Fiona?
No, this is not going to be an issue in the election. I don't think anyone's really going to base their votes on Paris in this election.
No, I meant the closeness to Trump in the same way that Tony Blair was diminished as a George W. Bush's poodle.
Well, I think that people are more wrapped up in other issues at the moment as concerns, the international stage and whether Theresa May or Jeremy Corbyn would be best placed to represent Britain on it. In terms of Brexit, though, it does show clearly that the UK is going to be out on its own on the international stage after Brexit, because normally we would be taking the same route as the European Union. We negotiated Paris as part of the European Union, and it's difficult to see what will happen to Britain's standing after Brexit, because within the United Nations, the UK is not does not have the influence that it would have had as part of the European Union.
That's Fiona Harvey with the Guardian newspaper in London. We're also joined by David Baker at the San Francisco Chronicle. Let me read a couple of emails we've had that came in and get back then after that. Let's see. First, we've got Antonio in San Leandro. He says, the only climate deniers are people who think we can do anything about climate change. Also, Wayne in San Mateo said, most people don't really understand how serious climate change is. And then also Art in San Francisco asks, are you seeing news coverage about current office holders and their stance on the environment? In other words, other governors and members of Congress who in 2018 have good environmental positions. If so, who are they? And what would you tell them if you were advising them about the way forward for climate policy? And two more emails here quickly. Robert in San Francisco says that animal food production contributes to climate change more than any other human activity. By the way, you'll hear more about that at the Bay Area Books Festival on Saturday with Paul Hawken on Saturday afternoon. I'm interviewing him about his new book, Drawdown. And an email from Elizabeth in Berkeley. Trump says that his rejection is for American workers. Can someone please give some detail about the economic impact of the Paris Accord if it were followed? What would it actually mean in terms of jobs? David or Fiona, do you want to jump in on that? And just have a couple minutes left here.
Well, in terms of the job impact, I mean, it's always you always go into this issue of speculation where you try to come up with some kind of decent indicators that will basic ways of modeling the economic impacts of any policy. It gets to be very, very dicey depending on how you put together the models. And Trump yesterday was citing a study that was showing that sticking with Paris would have a grave impact on the United States economy. That particular study has been criticized roundly for essentially using a set of assumptions that guaranteed the outcome of the study, that basically it started with assumptions that would pretty much only produce a negative result. I'm always myself very, very skeptical of any job forecasts, pro or con, based around government policies, because they all seem to have a particular axe to grind, all of the groups that put them out. But I would point out this. Governor Brown made a real point yesterday of noting that at the exact same time that California has been ratcheting down its emissions, its economy has been growing, and growing stronger than most other states. So if you're looking to us as a laboratory, as other states and countries sometimes do, California shows that, yes, you can have economic growth and cut your emissions at the exact same time.
David, one more question for you before we switch to our segment on books. I'll just note that I also have seen data showing that there's now roughly 3 million Americans who are working in the clean energy industries, which apparently is more than are employed in oil, gas, and coal combined. So those are not projections. That's today's workers. But here's an email from Lisa who asks, how do we square Governor Brown's apparent environmental policies with his positions on fracking and offshore drilling in California, which are not very aggressive in curbing global warming?
Well, fracking is a good thing to bring up and a tough thing to bring up in that, I mean, if you look nationwide, quite frankly, one of the main reasons the nation's emissions have gone down in recent years is because of fracking. It's because of the natural gas that fracking produced. And that is really what is killing off the coal industry rather than environmental regulations. It's the fact that fracking unleashed this flood of cheap natural gas. Now, we haven't had that same phenomenon here in California. The fracking that goes on in this state is focused on oil production rather than natural gas. And Brown was very much on the fence, as far as I could tell, for a while about it. But he decided that he was going to basically go ahead and let it continue in hopes that it would produce some economic benefit for the state as it had in other states. A lot of environmentalists have never forgiven him for that, and I don't expect them to anytime soon.
That's David Baker with the San Francisco Chronicle. Fiona Harvey with The Guardian in London. Can we just ask you one last question before you leave us? How is fracking an issue there in Britain? I know there's been some attempts to get it going and started, but has that become the kind of hot-button public issue that it is here in the United States, especially in places like Pennsylvania and New York State?
Well, we don't actually do very much fracking, but we do an awful lot of talking about it. So the attempts to get fracking going in the UK have not been very successful so far. They've run into a variety of problems, some physical, financial, to do with some to do with opposition and some to do with planning, regulations and so on. But there's still a determination and there are still funds flowing to fracking companies who want to exploit whatever resource turns out to be there. It is a hot political issue. The Conservative government under Theresa May have endorsed fracking. The other parties are either quite against it or extremely against it, depending on which one you pick across the spectrum. So there is a lot of debate. But it's in terms of on the ground, there's very little happening, and it will be quite a long time yet before we see fracking roll out on any scale in the UK.
Thanks so much. That's Fiona Harvey with The Guardian newspaper in London. She has covered every United Nations climate conference since 2004, including the Paris Accord in 2015. Fiona, thank you so much for being with us. And also David Baker, he covers energy and clean technology for the San Francisco Chronicle. His piece on the new alliance that Governor Brown has formed with Governor Cuomo in New York and Governor Inslee in Washington State is going to be on our website as well. David Baker, thank you for joining us very much.
My pleasure.
And we're going to switch now the conversation and talk about books. And the Bay Area Books Festival is this weekend. If you haven't got your tickets, it's not too late. It's Saturday and Sunday, 10 to 6, all day, food and all kinds of panels and discussions. KALW is one of the media sponsors, as is the San Francisco Chronicle and The Nation magazine. And joining us now is the literary editor for The Nation magazine, David Marcus. David, welcome to your call.
Thank you for having me on, Mark.
Sure. So, David, we live in a media environment that is obsessed with Twitter and instant quick hits and people reading on tiny handheld devices the size of their palm. As the literary editor of The Nation magazine, does this give you any optimism about the future of books? And how do you look at a festival like this weekend's book festival here in the Bay Area?
Well, in many ways, I think actually social media is a site for thinking about ideas and addressing a lot of things the back of the book of many magazines also deal with. I think that we also need those spaces, often fairly precious and far and few in between, that slow down and take these ideas more seriously in a more thoughtful and rigorous way. And I think that's kind of what the back of the book at The Nation does. It's also what places like The New Republic and The New York Review do. I think one thing that actually we often miss in this kind of particular moment is that politics is, of course, not just about policy and electoral campaigns and the latest havoc that our president has wreaked, but it's also a matter of the ideas that kind of undergird it. You know, what kind of life do we want to live? How do we relate to the environment? What do we owe to people around the world? And so I think that, you know, the types of reviews that I do in the back of the magazine are reviews that examine and interrogate a lot of those questions.
And yet, you know, we have a situation where book reviews, at least in the daily papers of the United States, are an endangered species and a virtually extinct species. You still have a book review at the New York Times, but it's much, much smaller than it used to be. The Washington Post used to have a separate standalone book review. It no longer does. Ditto with the Los Angeles Times. It seems, I admire your optimism about the role of books, but for some reason, that is not being shared by the major newspapers in this country.
I mean, that may also have to do with more structural and economic challenges that daily newspapers face as they adjust to the kind of 24/7 tempo of news and politics today. But I actually think we're witnessing a moment in which there's an incredible flourishing of criticism, often because of the web and because of the kind of democratic ways in which an institution like the Los Angeles Review of Books, which doesn't come out in print, or the way a little magazine like Jacobin can proliferate a lot of their work much more quickly. And so I'm actually a little skeptical of the idea that we're in a moment in which book reviewing is in decline. I actually think it's just migrated a bit from some of these more traditional venues.
That's David Marcus. He's the literary editor for The Nation magazine. We have just a few more minutes if anyone wants to join us at Your Call Radio. Here's the number. It's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Of course, you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're talking with David Marcus, the literary editor of The Nation magazine, in anticipation of this weekend's Bay Area Books Festival that's taking place in Berkeley, right there at downtown Berkeley at the main BART station at the park there, starting at 10 a.m. on Saturday through 6 p.m. and again on Sunday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. You can find all of the sessions, 100 authors from around the country and across the world, sessions and panels, and KALW is one of the media sponsors, along with The Nation magazine and the San Francisco Chronicle. You can find more information here at our website at KALW.org. David, you've got, I think just this week, the spring books issue, special issue of The Nation magazine coming out. Tell us a little bit about that, and also is the fact that there's no longer quite as much competition from book reviews in, say, the New York Times or the LA Times or what have you, does that open up extra space for you at The Nation magazine?
Well, so the spring books, we have two books issues in which I usually actually edit on a weekly basis a third of the magazine, and so I am gifted or burdened with editing the bulk of the magazine twice a year. And so this year we have reviews both on the literary side and culture and on politics, whether it's a review by the poet and Harvard professor Steph Burt of Cefa Milos, or the historian Eric Foner thinking about both the first and second Gilded Ages and how they kind of use the natural resources of America to fuel them. We also have a piece by Kim Phillips Fine on what she calls the two women's movements, which in the 1970s is both feminism and its backlash. And I think, you know, one of the great opportunities is that these issues give us an opportunity to remind people that there are a lot of things that are at stake that we often don't get to absorb in our daily consumption of newspapers that are as important. To answer your second question, I do think The Nation is in a particularly advantageous place to host a lot of young writers and also many of the already accomplished writers who do book reviewing. In fact, one of the things I have seen as kind of a mandate of the magazine review section is to find ways to kind of link a Jacobin writer or a dissent writer or someone from the little magazine world with an accomplished writer like Adam Kirsch, who writes for The New Yorker frequently, or Seth Burt, for that matter.
And we're sorry that you won't be able to join us out here in the Bay Area for the Books Festival this weekend, but I think you've sent some of those new issues of the Spring Books special issue of The Nation magazine to be there. We want to encourage people to come by the Nation magazine booth. It's going to be booth 88 at the festival. KLW will also have its booth there and coverage. A couple of conversations. In particular, I am moderating a conversation on Sunday afternoon at 1 p.m. at the main stage that is sponsored by The Nation magazine. It's called Race and Resistance in the Trump Era. And we will have as panelists the novelist Walter Mosley, the co-founder of Black Lives Matter, Alicia Garza, MSNBC contributor and national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, Joan Walsh, and also the author and Nation magazine contributor, Steve Phillips. He's the author of Brown is the New White. That's at 1 p.m. on Sunday at the main stage at the Bay Area Books Festival, and that will be broadcast later here on KALW. So one last thing for you, David. Looking at these kinds of book festivals, it's the kind of thing that, speaking as an author myself, I always feel rather heartened to see so many people engaged with books. And I wonder, when you go to things like, sort of, for example, the Brooklyn Books Festival, how do you feel when you're there? Do you feel sort of like overwhelmed by all of it, or grateful, or what?
Well, sometimes you're actually surprised by how many familiar faces you see in these very large gatherings. The Brooklyn Festival is actually in kind of downtown Brooklyn, and one of the things I like about it is it's right by City Hall, and so it kind of reminds you that you're both in a particular locus, and you're surrounded by a community of readers that you often don't meet. But on the other hand, you're in a world of politics as well as kind of literature. So, yeah, I think they're wonderful opportunities for an in-gathering of people, both from the world of journalism and the world of the arts as well.
It's funny. That's exactly the situation in Berkeley. The festival's right by the City Hall. That's David Marcus, the literary editor with The Nation magazine. We want to thank him. Also, Bill McKibben and Fiona Harvey and David Baker joined us earlier today. I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in this week for Rose Aguilar. And we are podcasting the show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. For now, this is Mark Hertzgard. Thank you very much.